All right. Hello, everyone. Oh, wow. Audience participation already. That's great, especially after the lunch super. My name is Daniel Roth, and we're going to be talking about what's new in Windows Communication Foundation and .NET 4.5. I'm a senior program manager at Microsoft. I've been working on WCF pretty much since I came to Microsoft. I started back when WCF was a not even released yet, V1 product. It used to be called Indigo. How many of you still remember when WCF was called Indigo? Oh, wow, yeah, you guys are like long-term fans of WCF. That's great. I worked on ServiceUtil. I worked on the WSL generation, schema generation, the serializers. More recently, we've actually been all merged together, a bunch of the .NET folks of WCF, ASP.NET, Entity Framework. We all sit really close to each other now, which is kind of unusual. We used to just stare at each other and throw tomatoes. Now we're actually all trying to collaborate. But we're going to be talking about WCF today. WCF has, what's new? Well, the answer is quite a bit. We've done a lot of work in .NET 4.5. I hope you're excited about some of the new features that you're going to see today. There are quite a few features, and I think they fall under basically two categories. The first category is we wanted to make things easier. We want to make things simpler. If there's one thing that when you talk to customers that they complain about when they're talking about WCF is, man, it's kind of complicated. There's a lot of configuration. There are a lot of knobs that I have to twiddle with. We really, in 4.5, wanted to try and reduce some of that burden, make it easier to work with WCF, make it easier to configure, make it easier to deal with your host, make it easier to deal with security, all those things. So first area we focused on was simplicity. The second area we focused on in WCF is really just making it a more modern and scalable service framework. That means supporting the latest, greatest, and hottest protocols like WebSockets. We had a UDP in there. And also supporting the latest, greatest programming models like the new task-based async programming models, so it's more easy for you to make efficient use of your server resources and achieve scale. So I'm going to talk about simplicity first. Like I said, sometimes working with WCF, you feel like you're in front of this kind of console, right? Like there's like 1,000 little knobs that you can twiddle with. When we looked at how we could simplify that situation, the first thing we thought is, let's make it so that you have to configure less, that the defaults just work more of the time, that you don't have to actually go in and tune things and twiddle with things to get them to work. Let's help you configure things less by integrating better with the host, integrating better, for example, with IIS and ASP.NET, inheriting some of the settings that you've already configured there. Why should you have to go configure, your SSL and security settings once in IIS and then do it again in WCF? Let's just do that once in one place. You're still going to have to configure some things. Real apps will require some fiddling with. But when you do that configuration, we also wanted to make that easier, provide you better tooling, better support, cleaner configuration models for actually configuring WCF. I love this quote. I think Thomas said this. I went searching for it again to verify it. I don't know if Thomas is here, if he can tell us, if he actually said this. But I think this is actually very, very true. When you look at the complexity in WCF, I can tell you that the intentions really were very good. We had two principles when we were designing WCF initially. One was about explicitness, that when you're exposing something to the wire, you're exposing services. In general, as a user, you should be explicit about what you're putting there, so you're not just accidentally opening up listeners and accidentally exposing data that you didn't mean to. And the other one was being secure by default. When you create these services, we wanted to make sure that you could feel safe about them, that they were secure, that they weren't going to be a liability. So these were. I still think these are good principles, but we probably took them a little bit too far. With these principles, we locked down the runtime so much that it kind of felt like when you're using WCF, you're in this big green grassy field, you're a developer running barefoot, running your application, and then boom, you hit a landmine and your app just blows up with one of these crazy exceptions. Socket was aborted, maximum bytes per read operations have been exceeded, the various reader quotas, timeouts. Sometimes it wasn't just that it blew up, but it just didn't work quite right, like it was slower, you're doing a lot of performance tuning. I think what really drove it home for me is I talked to our perf and stress teams about how they test perf and stress for WCF. And I asked them, you know, what configuration settings do you run with? And actually a lot of people were asking them this. If we would get a lot of customers that would say, how should we tune our services to be performant, to scale? And we would, you know, forward them along to our perf and stress teams who would tell them what they did. And they didn't run with any of the default settings, right? They were tuning things up to wazoo to get things to work right. And so one of the things we did in 4.5 is we talked to them and said, okay, you tell us what you're configuring. We'll actually make those the defaults. We'll put those in the runtime, and then you guys start doing your testing with the defaults, and if it's still working, then great. We've done a good job. And so that's what we did. And so we went through with a fine-tooth comb through a lot of the settings in WCF and updated them to be what I would say is, you know, more production ready, that you can just use them. You don't have to touch them. You'll notice that a lot of the settings are fairly dynamic in terms of what they'll be set to based off of the power of the box, like your processor account. I'm not going to actually go through each of these settings because hopefully you use 4.5 and you get these settings and they just work and you don't have to worry about them. That is the goal. If you're still on .NET 4 or earlier versions of WCF and you still have this question, you know, what is your guidance about how I should configure your services? This is our guidance. Like, use these settings and things should just work. We've had this slide now for a while in our presentations, and thus far it seems to be working pretty well. But let us know if you run into any issues with these settings, because the idea is that these things should just work most of the time. So that's one way we've enabled you to configure less. Another way is that we are doing a better job of integrating with the host. We're going to inherit the security settings from IIS, your SSL settings, your authentication modes. And actually, we will now, we also support multiple authentication modes per endpoint. Now, previously, if you wanted to configure a WCF endpoint that supported, you know, Windows and Basic and Digest and, you know, a variety of the transport security modes, those were each separate endpoints, and it was one per endpoint. And they often would sit at different addresses, like you'd have a URI, like an endpoint that was, you know, /basic or /digest, which was a little weird given that HTTP actually has a mechanism for negotiating that authentication protocol. So now we will support multiple authentication modes. Let me go ahead and show you that. All right, ignore that. That's a later demo. Okay, so I got just Visual Studio 2012 RC. We are in RC now. We are getting really close to releasing, so things are really locked down. I'm going to do File New Project, and I'm just going to create a vanilla WCF web application using .NET 4.5. Okay, and this is going to be a web-hosted WCF services, and it's the standard template that you've probably seen a million times if you've been working with WCF. It's using IIS Express, in this case, as its host, which is a nice development host, because it's very, very similar to an actual IIS server. One thing I'm going to do here is I'm going to flip this property in the IIS Express config and say, yes, I would like SSL. Okay? So that's cool. Let me make sure you see it. Now, normally, if you had done this previously, you would actually have to go in and add a WCF endpoint that really enabled SSL. I'm going to run this guy. This is going to bring up the little test client, which is spinning up the service and downloading its WSDL. And you'll see in the test client that I actually have two endpoints now. I don't just have a basic HTTP endpoint, which just does HTTP, but I also have one that does HTTPS. So we're automatically seeing that the host has SSL enabled. We're giving you an HTTPS endpoint just automatically. That's pretty cool. Okay, now I can configure some other things here. Like right now it has anonymous authentication enabled. Let's turn that off. And it has Windows authentication disabled. Let's turn that on. Okay? F5 again. Now, if you were doing it on 4.0, you probably would have expected that to fail, Because it would be like, well, I need to get the WSDL, and the WSDL needs to support anonymous access, and the endpoint was actually configured that way, and the host, though, doesn't support anonymous, so those things don't match, so, you know, blow up. No more. We'll actually inherit the authentication modes from the server, and we'll just use them. And we're smart about the metadata so that the metadata remains accessible. That was just one authentication mode, right? That was just Windows. Actually, just to make sure you can see that it is really Windows. You can see here in the config that it really did generate Windows authentication on the binding configs. All right. Let's now change this to actually use full IIS. I'm going to go into my project settings. I'm not going to use IIS Express anymore. I'm going to put this on IIS. All right, cool. Make sure everything still builds. Right, great. Now let me open up IIS Manager. And let's go do more than just one authentication mode. So let's see. It was WCS Service 1. There it is. I'm going to go into authentication. And what do we got here? We've got currently anonymous is enabled. Let's go ahead and enable basic is already enabled. That's great. Let's enable Windows. Windows is already enabled. Great. Okay, cool. So that looks, all looks good. I'm going to just browse. I don't need to debug because it'll just work, right? All right, cool. So it's up and running, so that actually ran. Let's go look at the WSDL, because I know everyone loves to look at the WSDL. And does that look right? Let's see. Actually, let me go back. Flat WSDL. This is actually a nice new feature in .NET 4.5. If you're familiar with working with Java stacks and like SAP, there's a lot of stacks out there that don't understand these little import statements that we put in our schemas and our WSDLs. They like everything to be in one document. I don't know why they hate standards, but apparently they do. So we added a feature to .NET 4.5 where we will actually go through and flatten the WSDL for you. Okay? Yeah. So you can just use that. You can download it. And I don't know why I'm not actually getting... That is my service. Let me make sure I configured my auth the way I thought I did. Basic. SSL is not able for the site. Credentials will be sent to clear. Whatever. That all looks fine. Let me actually try and debug it, maybe. Can't debug on the server. I don't see any policy statement here at all. Should I just enable SSL? Is that? I don't think I need to. It shouldn't force me to. Huh. Well, let me show you at least with the way that's supposed to work. I'm going to open up here the web.config. I'm just going to go to the root web.config on my box. And the reason why I'm doing this is this feature is technically not actually enabled by default. I think I did enable it. Let me make sure that it's still here. But what I did is I went into my root web.config, and I changed the default bindings for the basic HTTP binding and the basic HTTPS binding. And you'll see I'm using this new client credential type. And it's called inherited from host. Normally, you would put here like Windows, or you'd put basic or digest. In this case, what it's saying is, I'm not going to configure the authentication mode. I'm just going to pull it from the server. And I don't know why that's not actually pulling it up. I'm going to try one more time just to see if I can get it to work. It is my service, right? There it is. Yeah, I'm not getting any policy statements. I don't see any security enabled for this thing at all. Okay, well, I'm going to move on. I'm not going to spend too much time on that. It does work. I had it working earlier. What was the question? It is not the default. I pushed actually really, really hard to try and make it the default. There is a backwards compatibility concern there. Like if you didn't configure anything and you start inheriting security modes from the host that you didn't expect, could be an issue. So it is opt-in, but you can enable it for your whole box really simply going to web.config and saying, I'd like my bindings to inherit from host. All right. Now, there are still things that you will have to configure in WCF. And the way we help you do that is we give you some great new tooling. There's IntelliSense, a validation, a tooltip. I'll show you all that in a moment that you can use in your config files. We also cleaned up the client-side config generation so it doesn't look like just ridiculously long and messy. Previously, we would serialize every single default value into your client config files. We've cleaned that up. And lastly, we give you a way now to really easily configure your services in code, even when you're web hosted. Code has a lot of advantages. You can use the compiler to help you check things. You get IntelliSense in code. You can use IL as a way of sort of packaging up chunks of configuration and reusing them. So let me show you that. Okay. So what I'm going to do, I'm going to go configure this service now manually. And I'm going to do something a little bit off the beaten path because it's not one of the standard default endpoints that you would normally use. I'm going to use a binary HTTP binding. I'm going to use HTTP, but I'm going to binary encode the data instead of doing just plain text XML. Okay? So let's see. I'm going to do services. I know I need to configure my endpoint. Notice when I typed in services there, I'm getting tooltips now over the config elements. So this is helpful because there's so many knobs. You get some in-context help text on what the knobs actually are as you're going looking for the knob to actually change. I'm going to configure a service, and I'm going to add an endpoint. Let's see, for the address, we'll just do quote, quote. That'll be fine. I'm going to do a custom binding in this case because I'm doing something a little custom. And for the contract, for the contract, you notice I get a drop-down for the contract types that are in my project. So this is some IntelliSense over contracts. Let's see, where is my contract? There it is, service 1. I didn't add a name. I need to do that for the service 2, right? Notice I get IntelliSense over the service name. This is a string that's supposed to match your service type, and people get this thing wrong all the time. They forget that it's supposed to be the full name of the type, and they mistype it, and then the config picks up something completely different. Now you'll get IntelliSense to help you get it right. All right, that's cool. Now I need to actually configure that custom binding. So let me add a custom binding here. Binding, and give it a name. Let's call it binary HTTP. Okay, and so this is going to be a binary message encoding binding element and HTTP for the transport. Pretty simple. Nothing too crazy. Now I need to actually wire up that binding configuration, right? And this is one of those name references that WCF uses a lot of in config. And you'll notice when I go to set up the binding configuration, I'm actually going to get IntelliSense over those names as well. So the IntelliSense understands the names that you've added to your config elements so it can help you and get them right. That's pretty cool. Now, that's great, but let's say I go in. Notice that my service has these ones at the end of the contracts. Now, I know I should use a refactor gesture, and if I do use a refactor gesture, we'll go through and clean everything up right, but sometimes I don't use refactor gestures, and I just go ahead and modify the code. I know that's probably evil, but I do that, so I'm just going to go in and, hack these things. Okay, great. And I'm going to build. And apparently I can't code right either. What did I do wrong here? There. Thanks. All right. So the build succeeded, but you notice I'm actually getting still some warnings. This name attribute is invalid. The value WCF service 1 is invalid according to the data type. Let me go look at that. Oh, yeah. I forgot to change my config because I changed my type. I didn't change config. You're getting validation over your configuration. This one's wrong too. I changed the contract name. I didn't change the name in the config. So I up that, rebuild, and those validation errors have now gone away. So you get validation over your configuration files. If you get something wrong, we'll let you know. That's pretty cool. Let me show you to client-side config gen. So I'm going to add a new project. Let's do a console app. And I got a crazy binding in here. Let me make sure I've got IS Express setups correctly. All
I don't. So I went to IS. Let's see. I'm going to go back to IS Express just because it's. I don't need IS for whatever has not been configured. To keep these settings, you need to configure Virtual Trade. Like, yes, sure, go ahead. Sounds great. All right, and I'm going to re-enable anonymous just to keep things easy. Okay, now add service reference. Discover, there's my service, okay. And this does the normal thing. It's going to pull down the WSDL. It's going to spit out some proxy code and some config, hopefully. What did I do wrong? Let's see, provided as a, okay. So I like, this is one of the reasons why you should use refactor gestures. So view markup, you know, there's no one in that thing. All right, rebuild. Huh? Wait. This thing here? I already modified that, didn't I? Wait, where am I? Yeah, service. I did that. I did that one. This thing? Yeah, the file's right? SVC1. That's right. Right? Yeah, that should be. I didn't change the file names. I just changed the types. So we should be good. But I could be wrong. I've been wrong before. Let's see. All right, service one. Okay. Now it's going to work. I know it. Please. Okay. Whew. Okay, it worked. So here's my service. You know, I got my service type. That's great. But the thing I wanted to show you was the generated config. Notice that my config, if you had looked at this on .NET 4, this thing would look like someone threw up on it. It would have attributes all over the place. The binding now in my client config looks exactly like the service config, right? It's just a custom binding. I just hid it from you. It's a custom binding with a binary message encoding and HB transport. It's just what I wanted. So it's nice and clean. It's easier to modify. It's easier to keep track of what you changed, what you haven't. Cool. All right. Last thing I'll show you is code-based config, which is new feature. It's pretty cool. So I'm going to go to my service. And, you know, I'm going to say, you know, forget these pointy angle brackets. They're sharp. They scratch. I'm not doing that anymore. So I'm going to do public static void configure on my service type. Okay? And then there's this new type, service configuration, that it takes. Okay? And this is a convention. If you have one of these methods on your service type, we will call it and we'll pass in the service configuration. It'll look a lot like configuring a service host. So for example, I get the full service description. I can add, you know, behaviors to this thing. Like, let's add the service debug behavior, for example. That'll give me a help page. Or I can add metadata, my favorite behavior since I worked on it. Service metadata here. Yes. Great. And let's enable HB get metadata. True. You can do other things like you can add service endpoints. You know, and I have the normal stuff that you would get on a service host. You know, add address, contract, binding. Nothing too new there. There's a convenience configuration that you can do here where you can just say, I just want to enable a protocol. This is similar to, if you're familiar in .NET 4, we add endpoints automatically for you now, and there are a set of default bindings that we use to do that. This is a way for you to do the same thing as that default binding logic, but to be able to go in and specify what the binding you want it to be. So like I can say, you know, I'd really like to use the, you know, WSHB binding instead of the basic HB binding or whatever. And this will go through and add an endpoint for every contract on your service with that binding with a default address of quote. Okay, so you can do that. Actually, let's do the basic HB binding. So we're trying to keep things simple here. Another thing you can do here is you can load the configuration from the config file. So if you have one of these methods, by default, we'll assume that means you want to control your config, you're going to write it in code, that's fine, we won't do anything with the XML.
If you want to opt in to reading the XML, go ahead and call load from configuration and we'll load it up for you into the description. Even more interesting, let me move this up so you can see it, is there's an overload that will actually take a configuration object. So if you want to load configuration from some place completely different, like instead of from web.config, you want to load it from some share that you're centrally managing, you can do that using this code-based config model. You can package up common config tasks into APIs, and you just call them and use them. You know, this piece of code here that I wrote to enable metadata, that maybe was a little clunky. I could create a little extension method to service configuration that just did that for me when I call enable metadata, and it would just do it. You can, any tasks like that, just write an API, and now you've got that task encapsulated. So it's a pretty useful model. Okay. Now, just to prove to you this thing is actually being called, let me run it in the debugger. Okay, so there I got called, and it's going to run through my config and add it to the service description. And I get one endpoint, it's a basic HTTP endpoint. Okay? So that's code-based config for WCF. It's really nice when you're web-hosted where you don't have convenient access to the service host, but you still want to configure things in code. That's what we just did. All right, so that's some of the ways that we've tried to make WCF simpler, easier to use, that we've tried to make it easier to configure. We've done some other things as well. Often when you have configuration problems, you need a convenient way to diagnose what went wrong. WCF has always had a lot of tracing infrastructure, most of it in system diagnostics. In .NET 4, we started introducing support for event tracing for Windows. And that was nice because it's a tracing infrastructure you can actually turn on in production servers, and it's running really fast. It's kernel mode tracing, so you can feel pretty good about running it and not worrying about the performance hit on your services, whereas system diagnostics, you tended to have a pretty severe performance hit. In .NET 4.5, we've actually gone through and done a fair amount of work on our ETW tracing support and really fleshed it out, because before it didn't have a lot of the data that was available to you with system diagnostics. Now it's all there and available. So you can there's more rich ETW tracing available to you in .NET 4.5, which you can use to diagnose any configuration problems that you have. Let's talk now about how we've tried to make WCF more modern and also more scalable. Done this in a few ways. First of all, I mentioned before that we now support the new task-based async programming model. This makes it really easy for you to write asynchronous logic in your servers, in your services, and also to make asynchronous calls using the generated proxies. We've added support for some new transports. We support WebSockets now. It's a new hot thing. It is specific to Win8 and Windows Server 2012. But we support the protocol. We added support for UDP as an independent transport for doing like multicast scenarios where you care more about timely delivery of a lot of messages and less about reliable delivery of those messages. And lastly, we added support for doing add service reference for WCF in Windows 8 Metro applications. So let's go through a few of these things. For async, to write an async service operation, now all you have to do is return either task or task of T. And you can use the new C# language features, async and await, to leverage that programming model. Our clients, by default, if you look at the generated code, actually, I just generated one, didn't I? Well, I'll show you in a second. The generated code still includes the synchronous methods for like desktop code gen, but we now by default will include the task-based async method. So it's not a config switch you have to go turn on. It's just there. You can just use it. Now I'll show you what it looks like. Okay. So what we're going to do, I'm going to add another service to this project, and we're going to do like a service-to-service call. And that's going to do I/O. And so typically that's something you're going to want to do using an asynchronous call because that's going to use threads, and you don't want to block threads on your servers. That'll limit your ability to scale. So new WCF web application. Okay. All right. And let's go into this service, and we're going to change the, I'm just going to use the default template, but I'm going to change the text here a little bit so that you know that this is from backend service. Okay? And I do want to, let me use the refactor gesture now, because I want to rename this. Okay, and then I need to go here, and I want this guy to be renamed to 2 so I can see it. All right, good. Should still build. Great. Okay, so now I have another service. I'm going to, from my first service that we were already using before, I'm going to do an add service reference. Service 2, there it is. So generate me a proxy, and the proxy will already have task-based async methods generated on it, assuming that this doesn't give me any trouble. For some reason, add service reference is a little slow today. Okay. We have our service reference, so we'll look at the proxy type. Service 1, there's my service reference namespace. And here's the proxy type. And you'll notice that I have the synchronous get data calls, but I also get data async. And these are returning task of string instead of just string. Okay? And you can call these using the await pattern. You invoke the operation in the proxy, and you await the result. And the compiler will take care of doing a continuation so that you get called back when the call is actually completed. So let's write that code. I'll go to my service, and instead of doing my own string format here, I'm going to do client. I should probably just pull it out. Client.getDataAsync. I'm going to pass in the value that I got passed, and I'm going to await this. Okay. That's cool. Now, the compiler doesn't recognize that yet because my service operation also needs to be async. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to change this from being get data. I got to actually do it in my interface too. I'm going to change this to being get data async, and I'm going to return a task of string. Okay. Go back to my service type, and I'll change it there too. Get data async. Okay? And here I'm going to add that C# async keyword. And what that does is it tells the compiler, hey, compiler, there's some await stuff in here. I want you to go in and add some stuff that will, call the asynchronous operation that I'm awaiting, and then add in the continuation so that when that logic is done, the rest of the logic below the await happens. In this case, it would just return. All right? And then on the client, I should just be able to update this. I need to build. Build succeeded. Oh, I'm just going to delete it. I don't know why it's so slow. Okay, add service reference again, discover service 1. Add service reference is now using a cloud service to go and do some of its processes. No, I'm kidding. It's not doing that. okay. Service reference 1, this client type. Okay, and then let's do client dot get data async, and let's pass in 3. It's the number of the day. And actually, you can't attribute that entry point as async. So I'm just going to create a little async void run method here that has this logic, and then console dot write line the result. Await the result. Okay, we'll run it. That should work. Did I do it right? Did I miss anything? Whew. So this is a client talking to the middle tier, talking to the back end, right? You're calling some back end service from the middle tier. And it's all async, end to end. Here we go. That's the server side. We want to run this guy. Debug you. That's my configure method. From the back end service, 3. So that, obviously, I didn't write that code on the client or the middle tier because that was the only thing I touched on the back-end service. So all the way end-to-end async, you'll get better scale characteristics this way. And it's a lot like just writing synchronous methods. You don't have to do much to the method other than just return a task of the thing instead of the thing and add the await and async keywords. It's pretty nice. The async is a completely local concept of the piece of code that you're using to either, implement the service operation or to execute the client call. So you can have an asynchronous service operation and have a client that calls it synchronously. It's the client's thread that it's deciding to block, so the service doesn't care. They're decoupled concepts. So on the server, to implement an async service operation, I did change the contract. So are you talking about where you like are sharing the type for the client and server? So the task, that's a good question. So what does that task actually mean? The task is sort of a handle on the asynchronous logic that you're running. You're not actually going to take that task and serialize it. It's just a handle that says, here's some piece of work that I'm doing, and this task object lets you know when it's done. And WCF knows what a task is. That's the big change that we made in 4.5. So when you give WCF a task, it doesn't serialize it. It'll wait for the task to complete, and it'll get the result, and then it will serialize that to the wire. So that if you actually looked at the trace thing on the wire, all it was a string. The task was just a runtime piece to enable the asynchronous logic. Does that make sense?
So can you wrap the task around
if you had a piece of code, like a proxy to a Java service, right? Like you did add service reference to a Java service. That will generate you just another service reference, just like this one, because they're completely decoupled concepts. It'll generate you some operations for calling that service. Maybe it's, go back to option properties. There. Like, get foo from the Java service. But it'll also give you a method in the generated code that's get foo asynchronously from the Java service. So if you're like writing a WPF app, for example, and you really want to make sure you don't block the UI thread while you're calling that service, you can use that get foo async call, and that'll be asynchronous, and it will respect the synchronization context correctly, so you get back on the UI thread and all those good things. So all the benefits of the new asynchronous pattern in .NET 4.5, which I'm covering pretty high level here. If you want to really dive deep, I encourage you to go look at some of the white papers and blog posts from the CLR team on what they did in the core runtime. But from a WCF perspective, all you need to know is your proxies now support async using tasks, and you can use the await keyword. Just await the operation, and it will work. On the server, if you want to implement an async operation, you don't have to return an iasync result and implement an iasync result anymore. You just return a task or a task of T, and it will run asynchronously. Yes, question?
That was essentially where I was going, which is
Yeah. So the question was, what about the old way of doing things? Like, does that still work? Yes, it still works. Like, and you can have them side by side. This is in addition to. It's the new way of doing it, so we highly encourage you to use the new patterns. But if you've already got code that's returning async results, that'll continue to work. We didn't break any of that. Yes?
Did you mention that WTF automatically creates the async method for you on the contract layer? Because I can see that you have that get data using data contract async too.
Yes. This was automatically created, and it was done by default.
So, unless you implement a method which happens to match the same signature, with the same name, same everything, if when WTF enables the async, just like what you did on the service one?
So, yeah, on the server, WCF, the runtime knows how to look at the operations and understands that, oh, returning a task, that's just a normal service operation, but it's an async one. On the client, we wire up the generated methods to correctly call into the runtime so that they execute asynchronously. Does that make sense? Is that your question? Or?
Not actually. Can you use the code for that WTF service 2?
Service 2, sure.
Yeah, on that one, you define the get data async.
Uh-huh. This is the client, right? Like I'm calling a different service.
Okay, can you go to the definition of that one?
Of this client? Yeah, sure. That's my service reference code. So I'll go back to that's this one down here. Oh, sure. Yeah. So there it is. And it has get data and get data async. And this one I didn't do asynchronously. This one was done synchronously, right? Yeah, this is just a synchronous method.
Okay, so in there, if you don't implement the get data async, it won't work.
So this service, the way to imagine what I've got here is there's a console app, which is the front end client. Could be a WPF app, it's the client. And that's calling some middle tier service, which is service one. Right? And service, it's calling some operation on service one, and service one, to complete that operation, is calling a back-end service, which is service two. Okay? The logic in service two happens to be run synchronously. That was the choice of whoever wrote service two. Maybe it was just computing some digits of pi, and it didn't need to block the thread for that. It wasn't doing any I.O. So that's perfectly fine. The operation on service one that's doing that call to the backend service, this one, well, this is actually doing I.O., right? It's doing a web service call, and that blocks the thread. So you probably want to implement this service operation asynchronously. If you're calling other web APIs, services, doing time-intensive tasks, you probably want to implement an async operation. And with WCF, you have the option of doing either. It's just a question of how do you want the runtime to execute that method? Do you want it to run it synchronously or asynchronously?
What you're saying is that if we are, WTF automatically creates for you the code to run asynchronously and...
On the client. So when we generate client code for you, we'll generate code for you that's async. When you're writing your server, you have the choice. Do you want your operations to be synchronous or not? And you just write them the corresponding way. I'm gonna move on. If you have more questions, we can talk afterwards. Okay. UDP. So we've shipped a new transport in WCF. It's the UDP transport. We've had it in the runtime for a bit because we used it for our discovery support. But now it is its own binding. There's a new UDP binding that you can use in your applications. It lives in a different assembly, so you may be wondering, like, why isn't it in system service model? I can't find it. It's in system service model.channels. You may have to add that assembly to your project to get it, but it is there. And it's great for scenarios where, for example, you want to do multicast, where you want to broadcast messages to a lot of receivers, and you care more about the timely delivery than you do about reliable delivery of those messages. Examples could be like you want to send out a heartbeat to let your clients know that the service is still alive. Or, you know, you're spewing out stock ticker information. It's also a great way to do interactive communication with like a Windows Metro application. Like you want to be able to push stuff down to the Windows Metro application. You can do that using WCF because WCF is also supported in Windows Metro, Windows 8 Metro. I'm going to talk about that in a second. Some limitations about UDP to be aware of. We didn't provide WAS activation support. So if you have a WCF service hosted in like IIS, there isn't a way today for like a UDP packet to come in and that service to just light up. With UDP, it's interesting that in a lot of cases, the server and client are kind of flipped, right? Like it's often your client that's the listener. Like you've got a bunch of WPF apps and they're receiving pings from some service, but the service is actually a WCF client sending the messages, and the clients, the WPF clients, are receiving them. So they've got the listener. That's why it didn't happen. Feel strongly about it. We have our user voice site on that for WCF, and you can go there and add it as a suggestion. Also, there is no UDP support for multicast on Azure. So if you're using Azure machines, you can't do multicast across machines. I know it's a popular request, so feel free to add your vote to that user voice request. Let me show you what this looks like. So I've got a UDP sample here, and this is a stock ticker example. This first project is the source of the data. So this is a WCF client in the client's end, but it's the thing that's spewing out, you know, multicast messages with stock information. So here's my contract, and it's got a one-way operation on it, sends stock info, and it sends an array of stock ticks for different symbols. Got a data contract for the stock info, and here's the logic. You knew up the UDP binding. Here's my address. We support the SOAP over UDP protocol, which is a standardized protocol for shipping SOAP messages over UDP. It's the same protocol that under the covers we're using for discovery. I create a channel factory and with the address, and I create a channel. And then I just start a loop that's going to send stock ticks. So let me go ahead and start that service. Okay, so it started, and it's now sending stock ticks. No one's currently listening for those stock ticks, but it's sending them. All right, I've got two clients that are listening for stock ticks. This first one is just a console application. It's got the same contract, same data contract, but instead of a client, this has actually got a service host. It's got a listener that's listening on that multicast address for those stock ticks. All right, so let's start that one. All right. And you can see that it's actually receiving the data. Cool. And then lastly, I've got a second client. This is show the utility of multicast. I'm hitting multiple clients with the same pings. This is a WinForms app that's got some fancy charting of the data. But it's basically the same thing. If we go look at the code, again, there's the address. It's newing up a service host. It's using in the endpoint configuration, it's using the UDP binding, and it just opens it up. So I'll run this one too. Okay, so there we've got, let's see if I can put them all on the screen. There's two clients that are consuming multicast packets from the same backend data source. Okay? That's all done using UDP.
Can you have UDP binding with the Silverlight client?
There is no UDP binding, I believe, available on Silverlight. Okay? Cool. We've also added support for WebSockets. WebSockets, if you're not already familiar with the protocol, it's a new feature of HTTP, honestly. And what it does, HTTP typically is a request-reply interaction, right? Send a request, you get a reply. Pretty much end of story. WebSockets gives you a way to do full bidirectional communication, duplex communication, over what is really the HTTP protocol. It's built on HTTP, so it's using the same port, and it has some nice benefits that allows you to, for example, traverse firewalls. It goes through proxies. You don't have to poke holes in your firewalls like you would if you're using NetTCP. In some sense, it has some nice benefits over the same scenarios where you would use NetTCP. WebSockets is a good alternative. You can send binary or text packets on the connection. And the protocol it's a newer protocol. It's undergoing standardization, but it's supported in the Windows Runtime APIs on Windows 8. It's supported by IE10 is the browser that supports it. Chrome and Firefox also support it. Supported in IIS 8. ASP.NET 4.5 has low-level support for WebSockets in the runtime. We've added it to WCF 4.5. And all that support, though, is specific to the Windows 8 and Windows Server 2012 wave. You have to run your WebSockets functionality on that operating system. It's not supported down-level currently. Here's just a quick overview on how the protocol works. The client issues a GET request to the service, and it asks, it sends that upgrade header and the connection header, where it says to the server, please give me a WebSocket connection. The server then has the option to accept that connection. And if it does, it returns a 101 switching protocols response. And it says, OK, yes, I can do WebSockets. Here it is. If it doesn't support WebSockets, then it would just fail that request. And then from then on out, HTTP just gets out of the way. And you now have a full duplex channel. You can send messages either way. It's really useful for doing notification patterns where you want to push data down to the client. You can do binary or text. It's a really nice protocol to use on Windows 8 Metro clients because they support WebSockets. WCF is fully supported. The client side of WCF is fully supported within Windows Metro applications. And I'm going to talk a little bit about what that experience looks like and then show you a end-to-end using WebSockets with a Windows 8 app and a WCF service. The code gen on Windows 8 is a little bit different. When you do code gen on Windows 8 in Metro, there actually is no config anymore. There's no app.config. So you can either, some people celebrate when they hear that, some people look a little confused, but there is no XML configuration files in your Metro applications. Instead, what Add Service Reference will do is it will actually generate code in your proxy that contains the configuration, and then you get a partial method that you can implement to add additional configuration on top of the endpoint. On Windows 8 Metro also, there is only async. There is no synchronous method. So when you generate your proxy, you will not see the synchronous methods that you would see if you were generating for the desktop. That's because Windows 8 Metro apps are all about UI, and we really, really don't want you blocking the UI thread when you're writing Windows 8 Metro applications. So we try to help you do that by only giving you an asynchronous option. We do help you with dealing with duplex communication. Normally, when you're doing duplex with WCF, you have the service contract and the callback contract. And there's a pattern where normally on the client, what you end up doing is you create this instance context thing, and you kind of implement like a mini server on the client, and you hand that to the client proxy, and then the callbacks go to your service instance. Silverlight pioneered a different model where instead of doing that, you just get event-based callbacks on your client, and that is supported also in Windows 8 Metro. It's a limited set of WCF that's supported in Windows 8 Metro. You get the following transports. You're going to get HTTP, you're going to get TCP, and you get WebSockets. In terms of encodings, you'll get text and binary, so you do get the binary. Security modes, it's basically the transport security mechanisms. The message security mechanisms are not supported on Windows 8 Metro. The transfer modes, you can do full streaming and buffered communication. And we support pretty much all the serializers, the data contract serializer, JSON, and XML serializer. Okay, so what I'm going to show you now is an app that does WebSockets, Windows 8 Metro, and actually I also threw in some UDP. This is going to be a horse race application. I'll put it up so you can see what it looks like. Okay. This is just a little, simple little game. So there's three horses, blue, red, and green. And the goal is to get them to the finish line. Okay? And when I click start, what this will do is this app opens up a WebSocket connection to a WCF service that I have hosted in Azure. If you haven't been kept up with the Azure announcements, one of the nice things that they did is they have these free trials where you can just go and get VMs on Azure, and they have Windows Server 2012 VMs available. The website support that they have unfortunately only supports .NET 4, and so you can't use a lot of the new WCF 4.5 features there. But you can get a VM for Windows Server 2012. You have 4.5 on that VM because it's 2012, and then you can host your WebSocket servers on those VMs. So that's what I did. I put up a WCF WebSocket server on a VM in Azure, and then I've built a little web app that you can browse to. You can go to wcf45.cloudapp.net/horse-race-web. And you can go ahead and do this. And what you do is you just pick which horse you want to win and start clicking. And that's sort of like your, you know, yeah, you know, go horse, go. And that will send an HTTP request to it's really an MVC controller. This is where the diagram would be useful. So there's a Windows 8 Metro app web to a WebSocket server. There's a little browser app, which you just saw, which will talk to an ASP.NET MVC controller. And then that guy will use UDP to broadcast to all the WebSocket services that who you voted for. Okay? And then the WebSocket service will push it back down to the Windows 8 Metro client. Okay? And so the faster you click, the faster your horse will go. Now, I'll be honest. I haven't stress test this app with more than like three people. So I don't really know what's going to happen. But I am optimistic that this will work. Okay? So everyone, you can go to wcf45.cloudapp.net/horse-race-web. And I haven't started the race yet, so if you're wondering, how come the horse isn't moving yet? Because I can click start. Okay? So I'm click start. There go. Red's going. Red's going. Oh, there's blue. There goes green. Green's catching up. Let's go. Come on, red. My money's on red. Oh, you can't see it. Wait. Oh, my goodness. Okay, start again. Oh, you can't see anything. Oh, the rendering looks terrible. Oh, no. Well, you can see red. Look, red is definitely in the lead. Hold on. What's going on with the rendering? How come you can't see my... There we go. Does that work? No? Oh, lame. Here, hold on. I can't change this, can I? Do I dare do this? Is that going to work? I'm probably going to... The recording people are cursing me right now. Like, what are you doing? There. Now you at least can see them. Okay, the question was, what's the website? The website is... Not that one. WCF45.cloudapp.net/horse-race-web. And that's what you should see. Okay? Okay? I'm going to start again. Are you ready? I know. It's a little harder to hit the other one, isn't it? Well, are you ready? Okay, we're going. There's red. Oh yeah. Red's a little easier to click the button for, I know. But I have a cheat. If I have this little other app that just like it's like a little bot. Yeah, here we go. We'll do this thing. Come on, Blue. Oh no, Red's the winner, you guys. You're beating my .NET app. Oh, amazing. Okay, that's cool. All right. I'm gonna reset the screen resolution because that looks terrible. It turns to the other radio button. Yeah. Okay. All right, cool. So let's look at what that code actually looks like.
So here is the, this is the, not, that's not the horse race app. Here's the horse race app. So here's the MVC controller. So when you hit, you know, the submit button, why did that just change? When you hit the submit button, that calls this go horse action on the MVC controller. And in here you can see I've wired up, this is just a channel. Let me show you global ASAX. So in global ASAX, I new up the channel factory. So there's that right there. And notice it's using the UDP binding. I then create a channel, and I just save it statically in this this property, okay? And so the controller just grabs that, and every time you guys click a button, this thing gets called, and the UDP multicast gets sent out. Then I have a little UDP service, which is this callback service, okay? And if you look at the config, I'm doing the config using codebase config. I enabled both HTTP and UDP so I could generate my proxies and get metadata and all that goodness. I also enabled HTTP because I'm doing a little bit of a dirty trick here. Remember I said there is no WAS activation for UDP, unfortunately. So to get this to work, I'm actually using the HTTP endpoint. I ping it to warm it up, and then it's just a singleton instance that just sits there, and it will open on over UDP. It just, you can't activate it over UDP. Does that make sense? But it works. And then as the this guy receives the UDP packets, and then it has a little handshake with the WebSocket server. It has this event that it erases, and the WebSocket service and the UDP service sit in the same app domain. So the WebSocket service just listens on that event that it hears from the UDP service. So the UDP service says, "Hey, I got another UDP packet. You know, send another message down to the Windows 8 Metro client using WebSockets." Okay? And then on the WebSocket service, here's that event, that the callback for the event that it registers. And here it's using the callback channel to call back down the WebSocket connection. So when this service instance gets created, the WebSocket is a connection. It's like a TCP connection. So you get, by default, a service instance per WebSocket connection. When the service instance gets created, I go in and grab the callback channel. That gives me a strongly typed channel that I can use to make calls back down to the Windows 8 Metro client. And then when that event handler gets called, I just call into that channel. All right? And then lastly, if we go look at the Metro application, so here's the service reference in the Metro application. And like I said, it looks a little bit different. There's no, what am I looking at here? On horse received. Where's the go horse? This one does, should have start, right? I know I'm calling start this thing. Am I just missing it? Let me go to the, wait. Was where? Was in the base? Did I just miss it there? Ah, yeah, start race async, thanks. Ugh, just blind for a second. So that's the start method where when I click the button, it goes and tells the WebSocket server, first of all, create the connection. And here's, I pass it a little string to say, here's the race that I want to listen on. Okay. And then there's a callback channel, and you notice that on the derived client, there's this event, go horse received. And so I can just hook that event in order to receive the push notifications from the server. All right? And I want to show you this code here. Okay? And so here's when the start button is clicked. This just wires up the events handler for those pings from the server and then calls asynchronously the start method on the server so that once the pings start coming down, I'm listening for them. And as your pings come down through that WebSocket connection, it just updates the UI. So that's how it works. Whew. So that's everything. That was WebSockets, that was UDP, that was codebase config, Windows 8 Metro support, task async, all in one application. There's more. I don't have time to go through all of the goodies that are in
WCF 4.5. I'll just quickly mention what they are so you guys can go look up what these features are. We've added binary compression. So we know how to binary code data. We now support compressing it using gzip. We've fixed our upload streaming so that it now works. We added channel factory caching. I already talked about flat WSDL. We added good contract first support. You can generate a service contract from a WSDL that you can use to go implement your service using ServiceUtil. You can also just take schema files, XML schema files, and add them to your WCF service library projects, and you can just treat them as source code. And we have a build task that will actually build types from those schemas every time you build. And so if you like writing your types in schema, that's a really convenient way to do that. So you can do schema first. We support full international domain names, and I already mentioned the enhanced ETW tracing. Cool. So what's new in WCF 4.5? We tried to make things simpler. We have a new, more modern, scalable stack. We support WebSockets, UDP, Win8 Metro. There's lots of other goodies. I've tried to leave the last 10 minutes to answer any questions that you might have. If you want to learn about the other new stuff in .NET, I recommend these sessions. And thank you very much for coming, and thank you for your patience in some of those demos.